time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis. And this week in 1983, it was Operation Greylord all over the news. Remember, Anna?
It was absolutely. It was one of those things that just really took the whole county, if not the state, by storm. It was a sweeping corruption case known as Operation Greylord, Bob, as you point out. 1983, the FBI issued the first set of indictments this week, sending shockwaves across the city because it exposed widespread corruption in the county courthouse involving judges, attorneys, court staff, sheriff's deputies, and revealed a culture, really, of case-fixing and bribe-taking. The Fed said that justice was for sale. They found that judges were putting their judgments and favorable rulings up for sale in exchange for bribes, and that it was really widespread. The FBI operation ended prematurely when it leaked to the media over the summer. Then, fast forward to this week, they indicted 92 people, judges, clerks, lawyers, sheriffs, deputies, their assistants, and courthouse staffers, all indicted. As one prosecutor turned mole told jurors, the bribery system, like, created the, basically there were two systems of justice, those who pay and those who didn't. Central to bringing down all of them, attorney Terry Hake, who was the mole in the case, Bob, he posed as a corrupt attorney on the take. And here he is on a panel discussion later with John Bulldog Drummond, the investigative reporter, legendary reporter, on a panel talking about what happened.
And that case made history in another way, didn't it?
Another way, too. Yeah, Bob. It was the first time a listening device had been planted in a judge's chambers in the United States. The FBI got permission because of the probable cause. There was a lot of evidence out there, and they were able to get that in order to bring down one of the judges in that case. They instituted a lot of reforms, Bob, but a lot of people felt it didn't go far enough.
Right. This weekend, 1992, we were all talking about Mae Jemison, who made history.
Yeah, she made history when she became the first African-American woman in space. Mae grew up staring at the night sky from her home in Morgan Park, was a big fan of Star Trek back in the day, and dreamed of one day going to space herself. She was a Chicago Public Schools grad. She graduated Morgan Park High School early at 16. She also was a wonderful dancer, and she told her mom reportedly that she wanted to study dance or science in college, and her mother told her, you can always dance if you're a doctor, but you can't doctor if you're a dancer. So she ended up just saying, okay, listening to her mom, and she graduated with honors in STEM classes, graduated at 16, went to Stanford to study chemical engineering, then Cornell Med School, then the Peace Corps. By the way, she took dance classes at Alvin Ailey Dance Studios, at legendary studios, while she was in New York at Cornell. But then NASA came calling, and all those years watching the night sky here in Chicago came full circle. Here's Mae Jemison, interviewed by the BBC, reliving that awesome mission 3 decades after she launched into space, making history.
Mae Jemison, what a remarkable person.
Absolutely, and a remarkable life story. She's come back quite a bit, Bob, to Morgan Park High School, to the Adler Planetarium, to share her love of space travel and STEM careers, and I think that's a pretty cool thing that she's done that.
Yeah, I remember interviewing her. Very impressive. Let's talk about something Cub fans waited 36 years for and finally got this week. Back in what year was it now?
This was, oh my gosh, what was it,
2008.
You got it. Thank you. Your memory's better than mine. It was 17 years ago, and it was one of those remember that moments when Carlos Zambrano had the no-hitter, threw the no-hitter, and he wowed baseball fans because they had waited, you're right, 36 years to see a no-hitter for a Cubs pitcher. It was the first since Milt Pappas did it for the Cubs in 1972, and it was beautiful. We pulled this clip here.
Too bad it wasn't at Wrigley Field.
I know. That would have been great. You know, it's funny because there was Hurricane Ike going on, and so it was supposed to be a Houston home game, but they did it in Milwaukee, and it sort of was a home game because there were way more Cubs fans there, as you can imagine, than Houston Astros fans. So lucky fans that got to be there for that moment. Just an incredible thing to get to see.
Back to 1997. Man, do I remember this event. Anna?
You know, Bob, we're here in Chicago. They rolled on in for the Bridges to Babylon tour and were scheduled to play before a sold-out crowd at Soldier Field. 50,000 lucky fans set to see the Stones in what was billed as their greatest pyrotechnic show ever. And that was going to be exciting. But perhaps the most excitement in Chicago came a few days earlier when the Stones just showed up at a small Northside venue to perform a surprise gig. They took to the stage at Double Door in Bucktown Wicker Park, and 400 shocked bargoers inside were like, wait a minute, is that the Rolling Stones? Is that what? I mean, like, it was just a total surprise. They had paid $7 to get in. The Stones in Chicago go way back, of course, Bob, as you know, music heavily influenced by Chicago blues legends like Muddy Waters and others, who they got to meet in their first trip to Chicago in the 60s. Mick Jagger was asked in an interview, like, how as a kid from England were you so influenced by the Chicago blues and other blues acts? And here's what he said.
They've always liked Chicago, and I remember that concert, if you could call it that concert, because it was at 400 people at the Double Door. I was there. Ruined me forever. Yeah, ruined me. After that, I couldn't go see the Stones at the Soldier Field or any shows at United Center anymore after standing there like 10 feet from Mick, you know?
Bob, did you have an inside information on that? How did you just happen to be one of the 400 people there?
We were doing Fox Thing in the Morning, heard about it from one of my spies, and barely got in, but we did.
What an opportunity. A cool night.
It was something. 1997. Happy birthday, Virginia Madsen, today.
Yeah, Hollywood actress who rose from her North Side roots to an Oscar nomination. She was born on the far North Side this week, 1961. Her mom was a poet and an artist. Her dad was a Chicago firefighter. And around high school, they moved to the North Shore. She went to New Trier High School, known for its exceptional theater program, of course, and her older brother, the late Michael Madsen, who died this summer, also became a successful actor in Hollywood. Both studied acting in Chicago, did local summer theater programs, both dreamed of doing theater one day professionally, but didn't necessarily see the path until 1982. Virginia was working as a server on Rush Street at the hotspot PS Chicago, which you may recall, Bob, that was the big deal back in the day. Mm-hmm. And she heard that they were casting for these minor roles in a movie called Class, and so she got in line to sign up and auditioned, and it worked out for her. The fact that they were shooting here was like there was a surge in lots and lots of movies being shot here, so she got a speaking role, and she called it her big break. Also said one day, she told this great story about how she was shooting a scene downtown somewhere, and her manager from PS Chicago saw her. She was supposed to be on the clock and asked, what is she doing? Why isn't she at work? But it was the gig that launched her career. She went to L.A. and worked for David Lynch and so many other incredible films, worked steadily until she was earned her Oscar nomination in Sideways. So happy birthday, Virginia Madsen.
P.S. Chicago long gone, but happy to report the Candlelight Restaurant still going strong. Happy anniversary to them.
Yeah, no kidding, Bob. Think about it. How many great restaurants we have in Chicago, but how many have been around for 75 years? Really an accomplishment. The Candlelight Restaurant, if people don't know, it's a far north side, Western Avenue. It started by Italian immigrants back in the day. And these may be fighting words, Bob, but before Chicago was known for deep dish pizza, it was actually known for thin tavern-style pizza. Thin, salty, and cut into squares, and Candlelight was one of the best. They called it Candlelight because it was actually a romantic restaurant, one of the few in the, you know, Far Rogers Park Northside neighborhood. And today, though, more of a family-style pizzeria, still serving the same delicious pizza, pretty close to the, darn close to the same recipe, that Italian recipe from the founders. But there's a new owner, Pat Fowler. He was a delivery guy, a busser, and a server before taking over the business. And he got a chance to talk to WGN-TV recently when he launched another location by popular demand in Lincoln Park.
Big celebration at the Candlelight this weekend in Rogers Park. That should be fun.
Yeah, it's like, you know, they're allowing people to come in and that you can just sign up. I think you have to pay in advance. Maybe there's an RSVP going on, but they will be serving their delicious pizza. Bob, I'm not going to ask you if you like it better than deep dish, but do you like the thin crust pizza? Do you like it?
Yes, you know, you can like both. It's, you know, apples and oranges. I dig them both.
I like them too.
Glad in this city we have those choices. Anna DeVlantis, This Week in Chicago History. More next Wednesday. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you, Bob.